In this hour of midday, two personal stories from the aftermath of World War II. First, the inside story of Inside the Third Reich, the memoir of Albert Speer, German architect and high-ranking deputy in Hitler's government. Speer, the so-called Nazi who said sorry at Nuremberg, spent 20 years in Spandau Prison. It was a New York publishing executive, now in retirement in the Baltimore area, who secured the English language rights to Speer's book. Gerald Gross tells us that story in the hour ahead. And Susan Sullum tells the story of her father, Joel Fisher, and his leading role in a mission to find and recover gold, silver, and artwork stolen by the Nazis from victims of the Holocaust. Two stories from the aftermath of World War II on midday after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In this hour of the program, we hear two personal stories from the aftermath of World War II. Susan Fisher Sullum shares what she learned about her father a decade after he died, that he had played a leading role in one of history's greatest treasure hunts, the mission to recover billions of dollars worth of gold, silver, and artwork stolen by the Nazis from their Holocaust victims. Susan Sullum joins us a bit later in this hour. First, the inside story of Inside the Third Reich, the international bestseller by Albert Speer, architect, high-ranking deputy in Nazi Germany, and a confidant of Adolf Hitler. How Speer's famous book got to print is the story we hear from Gerald Gross. A veteran of the Army Air Corps, Jerry Gross became an executive in the publishing business after the war, and later a literary agent, as a senior vice president with Macmillan Publishing in the 1960s. Jerry Gross got to know Albert Speer and secured the English language rights to his memoir, Inside the Third Reich. The book provided a richly detailed look into the sinister world of Hitler's Germany. Albert Speer was known as the Nazi who said sorry, an architect admired by Hitler and later Minister of Armaments and War Production for the Third Reich. Speer stood trial with other Nazi leaders at Nuremberg. As the Nazi who said sorry, Speer accepted responsibility for his role in the crimes of Hitler's regime, but claimed to have been ignorant of the Holocaust. Judges at Nuremberg ordered the execution of 12 Nazi leaders, but not Speer. In the fall of 1946, he was sentenced to 20 years in prison. He served every bit of it, mostly in Spandau Prison in what became West Berlin. While behind the walls, Speer secretly made notations about his experiences with Hitler. Those notes, written on bathroom tissue and other scraps of paper, eventually became Inside the Third Reich, a memoir and international bestseller. One of the men involved in getting Speer's book to print lives in a retirement community just outside Baltimore. His name is Gerald Gross, and he's 93 years old. During World War II, Jerry Gross served with the Army Air Corps in Europe. The first time he heard of Albert Speer, Gross was on leave in England, and he had just survived a V-2 rocket attack on London.
At that same time, there was an article in the London Observer. And that article said, there is one man in Germany responsible for extending the war by at least 6 months. And that article identified one of the senior officers, the senior ministers of Nazi Germany, and his name was Albert Speer.
2 decades later, Jerry Gross was an agent for the Macmillan Publishing House in New York. In that capacity, he visited Germany, attending the book fair in Frankfurt.
20 years later, after that war, I was standing on the balcony at the Frankfurt Book Fair, looking down below where everything was so well organized. It just reminded me of the Nazi rallies that we all remember, line after line of soldiers. And the man responsible for that event was someone who joined the party around 32. He was a young man who happened to hear Hitler speaking. He was not in a maniacal mode, evidently. Hitler was just in a normal city suit and speaking to a group of young people who were quite impressed with him. And so this young architect by name of Albert Speer joined the party, and he soon took on an assignment and did it very well, and some ministers in the party took note of him, and then he took on another assignment and did it, completed it when people thought it would take a lot of time. He completed it well before the deadline and then impressed a number of people. It even came up to Hitler. And so Hitler, it seemed, had a fascination with architect, as many leaders often do. They want monuments that will outlast them. And there was soon what some describe as almost a homoerotic attachment in this young, attractive architect and Hitler looking at the plans. And eventually Hitler had in mind what once seemed possible when Hitler was in Paris for the first time, because at that time the Germans were well in command. We weren't quite in the war here in America, but it was an exciting time for all of Germania. As Hitler used to call it, he defined Germania as the future capital of the world, and he had plans. He had thoughts about it, and he worked with this young architect to design the new Berlin, which was to be the center of Germania. And that new Berlin was designed where the top palace was so large that the all of St. Peter's, the dome and everything else, would have filled the inside of this new structure that Speer had envisioned for Hitler.
Speer had been credited with revving up Germany's war production, slave labor a key part of it. A confidant of Hitler, Speer claimed to have plotted to kill the dictator in the final year of the war. He also defied Hitler's plan to destroy the German infrastructure as the Allies approached Berlin in 1945. Throughout his trial at Nuremberg, Speer presented himself as no ideologue, but as an artist pulled into the service of the Reich. Jerry Gross knew that if anyone could provide the inside story, it was Speer.
The 20 years were up, and Speer was coming out of Spandau. And it so happened it was October 66. And either one year the fair is in October, and one year the fair is in September. This year it was in October. And I'm there meeting up with my fellow publishers from other countries. And one of my favorite erudite and brilliant publishers in London was André Deutsch. And André and I were there together at one point, and we said, hey, what about Speer coming out? Why don't we go after his memoirs? And I said, that would be great. André would take the UK and the English Empire, and I would take America and Canada, and that's how that was the common division then. For what we call the world English language rights. And those rights were what we were after. And then we decided we'd just call Frau Speer in Heidelberg, which was where they lived, to this was a few days before Speer actually got out of prison, because Frau Speer, of course, met her husband at Spandau when the doors were open and all the paparazzi and the whole world was looking on. And so André and I decided to call a few days ahead. And then André pointed to himself and said, Hungarian Jew? New York Jew to me? And so who's going to make the call? And I said, well, my sales manager, Fred Kobrak, is a good Czech. He speaks excellent German. So Fred made the call for us, registered our interest, and that was it.
Gross remembers meeting Speer for the first time and learning about their common love of classical music.
I booked my day in Heidelberg, and I went to the gates of his home, high gates, and behind was a very big German shepherd. And he knew I was coming, of course, and he was looking forward to it. And he came out joined the German Shepherd, and then his wife joined us and greeted me. And he was living in his old family home in Heidelberg. And it was there that I would visit with him very frequently because Siedler, his German publisher, and the great newspaper publisher, Joachim Fest, were working with him. Fest had written one of the best biographies of Hitler, and they were assembling all this stuff, all the toilet paper notes and all of that, and it was a tough piece of work. He was charming. He was dignified. He was somewhat elegant. He was still a very handsome man, and we had many things in common, one being music. At the very end of the war, when the Red Army was coming into Berlin and all was on the edge of chaos and Hitler was down in the bunker, Speer had some of his closest friends sit for a recital with the great German pianist Wilhelm Kempf. And while the Russians were coming in, there was Kempf with this close bunch of friends playing Beethoven and Schubert for 4 hours straight. What a time. No one has a sense of that image.
When the war in Europe ended in the spring of 1945, Albert Speer was in Hamburg, then briefly with the so-called Flensburg government before his arrest. He provided information about a broad range of subjects for Allied investigators, but maintained his ignorance of the Holocaust.
He tried to maintain that for many years, and there was one frightening meeting where the final solution was discussed, and that was chaired by Himmler and attended to by Heydrich. And, of course, Speer claimed that he had left the meeting before those discussions began. And he took that stand for many years after the books were published. And
other than his story, you had no other way of knowing whether his story was correct or not. Was any effort made to establish whether he knew or didn't know, independent of his own statements?
There was a slight insertion made by Speer to try to deal with it, but it wasn't very successful in all terms. And I made it a point to make it somewhat easier for me to deal with all of this. I had him agree to all of his royalty income from our edition would be directed to an American Refugee Aid Association. That was never public knowledge of the time. In fact, the only people who knew about it was myself and my financial manager at Macmillan, who saw to it that the cash that would have gone to Speer went to the Refugee Aid Organization. Of course, that money was Ullstein's, and they divvied out the American and German and French and all the editions that they commanded to Speer. But to my knowledge, no income of any other nation that published the book with great success ever diverted the money as we did here in America.
Still, history remembers Speer as the Nazi who said sorry, something that evidently impressed Francis Biddle, the U.S. Attorney General who served as the primary American judge during the Nuremberg trials.
He said sorry, and he said not guilty. But he came close. That there was a tremendous wealth of legal talent working for the Allies at that time. And when the judges had to make their decisions, the first judgment on Speer was that he be executed. And then Francis Biddle, the next day, changed his mind. And because of that change, he got 20 years. But he came very close to execution.
Published in 1969, Inside the Third Reich was critically praised and an international commercial success. It provides the most detailed descriptions of the inner workings and leadership of Nazi Germany.
The total sense of what the government might have been like, because there were so many people of what turned out to be of no repute. I mean, the Allies knew that there was one individual who was worthy of note, and they recognized that as being Speer. And Speer took it upon himself to write about the intricacies, the low ball playing, and to give an intimate sense of what it was like to be with Adolf Hitler. It was recognized that this was an inside person telling a story that no one but an inside person could tell. And it happened to be told by a very literate, sophisticated fellow. The critical reception was astonishing in that the book sold. It was a very big bestseller. People wanted to... It easily was conveyed that this was a kind of inside story, as we couldn't get it from anyone else. And one thing helped. There was a great war correspondent, not really properly credited, who Jim O'Donnell, who wrote for Collier's very often. And I got to Jim and had him visit Speer, and he ended up writing a lead piece about 3 weeks before publication in the New York Times magazine section called The Devil's Architect. And that was all about Speer, and that helped a great deal.
Speer later helped Jerry Gross verify the authenticity of the diaries of Joseph Goebbels, the famous minister of propaganda in Nazi Germany. Speer died of natural causes in 1981 while in London. He wanted to visit the U.S., but never made it here.
He had a great desire to visit the States. He wanted to see the national parks more than anything. And he had it all figured out that he would enter via Seattle to create less publicity. But he never made it. But that's what he wanted to do.
In 2007, a quarter century after his death, a letter written by Albert Speer surfaced. It was a letter he'd written in 1971 to the widow of a Belgian resistance leader. In that letter, Speer admitted being present in 1943 at that conference where Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS and Gestapo, had unveiled plans to exterminate the Jewish people of Europe. Clearly, Speer's insistence that he had left the room before Himmler spoke at the conference contributed to the decision to spare his life at Nuremberg. We take a break now on midday, and when we return, we'll hear from Susan Fisher Sullum, whose father, a Washington attorney named Joel Fisher, led a top-secret mission to locate and return billions in money, gold, silver, and art looted by the Nazis as World War II came to an end. Please stay tuned. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Susan Fisher Sullum. Susan Fisher Sullum is a Baltimore resident who had a trove of history stored in her basement and didn't know it. She had moved some of the personal papers from World War II that belonged to her father into her basement after his death in 1997. And there they sat until 2005 when the phone rang and historian William R. Wells was on the line. Susan Sullum joins us in the studio today to talk about what she discovered about her dad after that phone call. Susan, it's nice to have you on the show.
Hi, Dan.
For many years, Susan Sullum was press secretary for U.S. Senator Ben Cardin.
Yes, I was.
And used to come to our studio with Ben, but he did all the talking.
He did. This is very different.
It is. So it's nice to get with you. A year after you first wrote about this for the Washington Post Sunday magazine.
Right.
A story called Monuments Men, a Baltimore writer learns her father helped in the search for Nazi plunder. Well, Susan, first let's talk about your father. Name was Joel Fisher, and I say a Washington attorney.
Yes, he was. He was a very well-respected Washington attorney. practicing mostly in aviation and theatrical law. He had a bigger-than-life personality, and people have said to me he was really a cross between Lyndon Johnson and Perry Mason. And he was. He was friends with William O. Douglas, Walter Winchell, Leonard Lyons, Scoop Jackson, Senator Scoop Jackson. He was a personality that could just sort of suck the air out of a room. He once bragged he'd even dated singer Dinah Shore, you know, but he never, ever talked about any of this to us or any of his friends who have contacted me since
when
my...
When you say this, you mean World War II?
World War II, any of this. I've been contacted by his former law partner, his former secretary, and the 98-year-old widow of his best friend, who all said to me, we never heard about this. He never talked about it.
One thing about your dad's law practice, aviation and theatrical law.
Yes.
What an interesting combination. So aviation meaning aviation like contracts?
Well, no, in those days in Washington, the CAB, the Civil Aeronautics Board, determined all the routes of the airlines. So he was really a K Street lobbyist before there was such a thing. He would go down to the CAB. He would, you know, finagle and try and get the best possible routes for his clients. And he was also the Washington representative for the New York Theater Guild. So as a kid, I mean, I remember actors and various people at our house for dinner.
Where did your dad grow up?
He grew up in Baltimore. He spent his early childhood in Reservoir Hill until his father passed away when he was about nine, and then he and his family moved to Brooklyn, New York, and he grew up the rest of his childhood and teenage years in Brooklyn, New York.
Your father, Joel Fisher, had some experience with the U.S. Treasury Department, right?
He was, after he went to Syracuse Law School. He went first undergraduate Syracuse, then law school. When he graduated, he became a young attorney at the U.S. Treasury Department. Right after that, or shortly after that, World War II started, and he tried to join the Army and the Navy and was turned down for bad eyesight and flat feet. He finally got a commission as an ensign in the U.S. Coast Guard because the Coast Guard was under the Treasury Department. And I think there were certain people who pulled some strings to get him a commission there. And within a year or two, he was assigned to General Eisenhower's staff in London called SHAFE, which stood for Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, in their G5 division, which was their financial division. And he was made head of Foreign Exchange and Property Control Section, and promoted to Lieutenant Commander.
Foreign Exchange and Property Control.
Right.
Which gets us to the subject of today's talk.
Right, right.
I was very curious about this. Being so busy with a war, how did the U.S. Army, the Eisenhower and his staff at Supreme Headquarters become interested in Nazi plunder?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. In the very closing days of the war, in February 1945, the war ended May 8th, 1945. In February 1945, the Yalta Agreement was signed with Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. And it divided up post-war Europe into four sectors. On April 6th, 1945, so a little over a month before the end of the war, I should preface this, that Patton was sweeping through the heart of Germany and liberating many towns. One of those towns was Merkers. And two MPs on the night of April 6th stopped two displaced women. They had been slave laborers. They were French. One was very pregnant. And they said they were out looking for a midwife. The MP said, "We'll drive you into the town of Merkers." And along the drive, one of the women said, "That's the mine where all the treasure is buried, 700 meters down."
The mine, meaning a salt mine.
The salt mine.
In this town of Merkers.
Town of Merkers. And it's really called the Kaiseroda Mine, but it is in the town of Merkers, and it's often just referred to as Merkers Mine.
So the women were slaves.
They had been slave laborers for the Ohrdruf slave labor camp, which was liberated the same day that Merkers was. And they were wandering around. There'd been a curfew. The MPs stopped them, and they were driving them into this town. Well, the intelligence officials had heard rumors of this, of large caches of stuff being hidden in banks and mines, and they went down to that mine for the first time April 8th, 1 month before the end of the war, and they found unimaginable treasure. The Merkers mine alone contained about $300 million worth of gold alone.
Now, getting back to your dad,
yes,
Joel Fisher, who's in the Coast Guard but assigned now to the Supreme Headquarters.
Headquarters, right.
He got a special assignment.
He did. He was given the assignment to inventory all the mines and all the Reichsbanks in the whole Merkers region. They had gotten intelligence that the Nazis were trying to ship it all out to Switzerland and apparently had agreements with the Swiss bankers that they would take it as long as they could transport it, but they couldn't transport it. So what had happened is the Nazis were beginning to move all this stuff out of Berlin ahead of the advancing U.S. troops and hiding it in these salt mines and Reichsbanks. So my father led a team of 75 men called Task Force Fisher.
Named after him.
Named after him. It's hard to imagine. I mean, he wasn't even 30, you know? And here he was, a lieutenant commander, and he was leading these 75 men. One of the stories he only said—
And their mission was to locate this
to
stuff.
Locate and account for all of this.
Wow.
And he did. I mean, in his papers, I found newspaper articles, and I even found a script for CBS Radio Report to the Nation that he gave in 1945 when he came back from the war. Between 45 and 46, he gave numerous interviews, New York Times, Washington Post, magazine articles that laid out everything. And that was what I found, along with the top secret papers, that drove the narrative.
He never talked about it. I find this remarkable. There's a quote from your story where you quote your dad,
yes,
in his interview with the Washington Post.
Yes.
The first thing that greeted us were open boxes filled with wedding rings, gold teeth inlays, and gold and silver picture frames. The owners, we were informed by German guards, were dead. Right in the middle of the cold, white salt beds were these wooden crates. I got hold of something sharp and pried one open, and there was one of those beautiful paintings.
Yes.
So this is an interview your dad gave to the Washington Post in—
Yes, 1945.
Okay, so I want to go back to your father for a—
Yes.
—minute, and then we'll come back to the story of his mission.
Yes.
It's remarkable to me that you could grow up in the same house with this man.
No.
And he's your dad.
Yeah.
And he never says— he never tells you the story of being a monuments man.
You know, he actually wasn't a monuments man.
Well,
because they were the art—
They were just the art guys, right? I understand, but he was close to that.
But I will say, he only said two things to me ever about the war. In 1970, the movie Patton came out.
Oh,
I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, sure,
that.
George C. Scott. Yeah.
Yeah, George C. Scott is Patton. And I remember him saying to me, I remember General Patton. He was such a son of a bitch. I remember crossing his lines with my men to get to the salt mines in Weimar, and he stopped us and gave us a really hard time. And then he said, that Patton had said, well, I have to let you go because you're Ike's boys. I'm 20 years old.
Yeah.
I'm protesting the war in Vietnam.
Right.
I have—
Right.
—no clue. I never ask, what's a salt mine? Why are we rushing there? What's going on? Never asked a word.
Hmm.
Second thing I ever remember him saying was, when I was really little, my parents were very in the news business. My mother was a journalist in Washington at the time. I remember seeing a political rally on TV in which people were holding up placards that said, I like Ike. I like Ike. I like Ike. And I was a little girl, and I said, I like Ike. And my father said, no, we like Adlai Stevenson. And I'm like, I didn't like that. I want to like Ike. And my father said to me, I'll never forget this. He said, I will never vote for him. He used to call me his Jew boy. And I was a little girl. And never, I didn't even understand what that meant.
Yeah. You didn't even, you didn't think of saying, you knew Eisenhower?
No.
Right? You worked for Ike Eisenhower, right?
Nothing.
You're too young to appreciate that.
I totally didn't understand that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and that's all you ever heard from your
really
father about the war.
Well, there was one other thing. He, when Paris was liberated, Eisenhower's chief command was moved from London to Paris, and my father became very good friends with Alice Toklas and Gertrude Stein, and every week he would get a jeep and drive them to the PX every week for groceries, and they loved him and called him Santa Claus until they died. And I have letters from them to my dad.
He must have been a gregarious guy, your father. You said larger than life.
He was.
And so he easily made friends with people, contacts with people.
Oh, he was unbelievable.
And he ended up running this mission with 75 men. What is it called? Task Force Fisher.
Right.
More on that when we get back with Susan Sullivan. We'll have to take a break here. We're going to hear the rest of this story about Susan's father, Joel Fisher, and the mission that he undertook at the end of World War II to recover all this loot that the Nazis had stolen and hidden. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. We're spending this hour with a couple of personal stories from the end of the aftermath of World War II. Susan Sullivan with us, telling the story about her father, Joel Fisher, something he did during the war that she didn't really know about until, 10 years ago?
No,
was it?
Actually,
less than that.
It was 2 years ago.
Yeah, really, 2 years ago.
I was first contacted by Bill Wells.
To go back to William Wells.
He was a great guy.
He was a historian of the Coast Guard, right?
He was. And he contacted me 10 years ago to say, I saw your father's obit on New York Times obit online, and I wonder if you have any of his diaries or papers. And at the time, Senator Cardin was running for the U.S. Senate, and I really had no time. So I said, you know, I'll take your information, and when I get a moment, I'll try and look. And then I totally forgot about it. And 8 years later, in 2013, he called me, and he said, you know, George Clooney's working on this movie. Well, that perked me right up. And he said, just file for a copy of your father's military service record, which I did. And it took a while to get. I did get it. It turned out I thought his name on his birth certificate was Joel, but it was really Joseph. They couldn't find it. I then went down to my basement, found all these top secret documents, and eventually I did get his personnel records.
So the documents
that was 2013,
right? And that was from you had stored those away sometime after he died.
When he died, he died in 1997,
right?
In the fall, and that summer, so the summer of 98, my husband and I, all his law practice files, cabinets full of documents, had been stored in a storage facility in Northern Virginia. So my husband and I drove down there. It was 95 degrees. There was no air conditioning. There was one tiny light bulb, and this thing was cavernous, this storage facility. And we spent an entire day going through whatever we could and taking what we could fit into my minivan. And we drove it all back to Baltimore and stored it in my basement where it sat undisturbed for 15 years.
And what did you discover in there about the mission?
Well, my dad, I think I mentioned, was given the task to inventory all the salt mines and Reichsbanks. So he and his little band of men, 75 men, really went, followed U.S. troops as they went from town to town. And one, just an example of what happened, in one Reichsbank, in the Plauen Reichsbank, on April 26, 1947, They arrive and the
1945.
Mm-hmm. They arrive and the director of the bank says, "Yeah, there's treasure in there, but you know, the vault door is locked and the key to the vault is in the pocket of our employee who is under a pile of rubble from an Allied bombing raid. So we can't possibly open the door to the vault." My father got an engineering company to blow open the doors, and in it they found 35 bags of gold coins weighing approximately 1 ton, which had all been deposited by the head of the SS, Heinrich Himmler, a full year earlier, April 1944. They also found 17 bags of gold dollars, 1 million Swiss gold francs, 151,000 Norwegian gold kronen, 22 bags of silver, and 98,000 Dutch gold guilders. The next day, they went to another Reichsbank, and they found 198,000 pounds of silver representing the entire silver reserve of Hungary. It just went on and on, his missions.
I don't want to assume that we understand what the Hitler, what the Nazi regime was going to do with all that. They were just storing it in order to accumulate wealth.
Oh, absolutely.
To create for their state banks so that they would be able to continue to a war, right?
It's as if the Nazis walked into Fort Knox and just looted it. And they did it with every single bank, every single country they occupied. And as the war was winding down and it was clear they were losing, their hope was to get it to Switzerland so they could keep funding their Nazi effort. Yeah.
And do we know a lot of this traced back to families who were victims of the Holocaust, right?
The artwork, and certainly in the Merker's mind, they found many tons of personal possessions owned by victims of the Holocaust, you know, jewelry, candelabras, all sorts of stuff. But most of this, the silver, the gold, the bullion,
was state currency.
Mm-hmm. It took 52 years to get to finally go through and figure out which countries own this stuff. There was a gold conference in London in 1997 in which Ambassador Stuart Eisenstadt was the U.S. representative. That was the year my dad died, 52 years after the end of the war. The final deposition of all that gold and silver happened then. And what happened, there was approximately, they had been giving this stuff back, but the Cold War had slowed down the process because they weren't going to turn it over to countries in the Soviet bloc.
Well, your father's mission, actually, they worked very fast because they were concerned about the Soviets getting to this stuff before they did.
It was all in the Soviet sector.
Yeah.
And the war ended in a month. But what happened is there was $60 million, 5.5 tons remaining in 1997 that nobody could prove who owned it. And Stuart Eisenstadt and other representatives to that conference came up with a plan to get all the countries whose central banks were looted to turn it over to a fund for the Holocaust victims and their survivors. And they did that in 1997.
Since this story came out and you were published in the Washington Post, I know you've been asked to speak and tell the story at different places.
I have.
Have you heard from people who said, you know, my father never told me what he did during the war because it was too horrific, or he just didn't want to talk about it?
I have had a lot of people come up to me almost every time I speak and tell me various stories about their relatives, how they may have escaped from Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. They had to leave their belongings. It just goes on and on. It's still out there.
Well, most people who didn't want to talk about experiences in war, those who were in combat, who served in the military, it's because they just don't want to go back to those memories. We assume that. Yeah. And in this case also, people who were victims of the Holocaust often don't want to recount that for people. But here, your father did something
so
led a mission that, it's a really remarkable thing. And I wouldn't say, a positive story. I'm just saying it's not a story of, it is a story of horror when you associate the Holocaust with it,
right.
Obviously. But he wasn't, it's not like he was telling you about
horrible things that he
had done, what I mean? So are you a little surprised that he didn't tell you about that?
Well, you know, people, every time I talk, people ask me that. They asked me that question. Why didn't he talk about it? And I think it's a couple of things. I think after the war, he just wanted to get on with his life. He had an incredible career after the war. He was Henry Wallace's chief of staff, who was Secretary of Commerce right after the war. In from 47 to 1950, he was chief counsel of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee in Paris and very involved with getting the displaced Jews of Europe into Palestine or other places. So he had this incredibly exciting life, and there was always like some other big thing happening.
Yeah, I get it.
You know?
Yeah, I see that. And he was young, too, when all this happened.
Very young. One of my siblings, when I told him about all this stuff I discovered, said, well, I remember hearing about the gun running to Palestine. And I'm like, I never heard that, you know? So I think he was
just... So is that a piece, too, of Joel Fisher?
I think I have to do more research. It may be.
You have to spend more time in the basement with all those records, Susan?
I have to go through the archives. And it's funny, when this story first came out, the National Archives called me and they said, we would like you to bring your material down so we can see if you have something we don't see. And I said, sure. You know, I drove down to College Park. I brought everything. And I met with three of them, and they went through it for a couple hours, and they said, we have all this. There were multiple copies made in those days. And then they told me an interesting thing. They told me it was all declassified in 1976, which I didn't know. So that was interesting.
Have you visited any of these places, or do you plan to? Merkers or...
I would really like to. There's the Plauen Reichsbank.
Yeah.
There's Magdeburg.
Have you thought about doing that?
I would like to. I have a daughter who lives in Switzerland, and my hope is one time when we're over visiting her, I can do this. But I really would like... I need to do research at the archives. There was one interview he gave after the war that I did not include in any of the pieces I've written about or really talked about, in which he was asked by a reporter what he thought of Truman's plan to use 25 million of the recovered Nazi loot to relocate the Jews of Europe to Alaska. And he said, great idea.
Your dad said that?
Yeah. And I know somebody
I didn't know that was such a plan.
That there was apparently
Truman had talked about that.
Apparently, I asked. He was then chief counsel of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, and I asked the former president of the joint if she knew anything about it, and she said, "Oh, absolutely. The plan was to use Alaska Airlines and get them to Alaska." And my dad was on the board of Alaska Airlines.
Wow.
So I think there's a lot more out there to it.
By the way, in Plauen, at the Reichsbank in Plauen, is that the one they blew up? They didn't have the key to the vault?
Yes. That was the one they blew up.
And someone there, a bank official, said, well, you'll never blow it. You never blow it, and they did.
And they did, and they said, poof.
Poof.
Right back to them. They were so angry.
One thing I'm not sure we made clear is that all of this happened in a fairly short period of time.
Very short.
Your father's mission, Task Force Fisher, was this all of 30 days or so?
It was about 30 days from early, or even a little less, from early April when they found the Merkers mine, which was April 8th, the first time they entered it, until May 1st, 1945. That was his last mission, which was to the Nuremberg Reichsbank. He had traveled 1,900 miles and had recovered 6.6 tons of gold and 9.4 tons of silver alone. On his very last mission, he went to the Nuremberg Reichsbank, showed up, and found the bank director had just burned 750 million French francs worth $17.2 million. But they still found unbelievable amount of... gold. They found
the bullion.
They found 1.8 tons of gold that had been shipped from Holland. I mean, they were just looting every country they occupied.
So from the records, can you tell how much of plundered loot they actually recovered? Did anyone ever try to calculate that?
Yes. Stuart Eisenstadt wrote a report in 1998 that was published that accounted, and a lot of the documents I have were included in this report. At the time, as it was going on, they really didn't have a good accounting. But in this 1998 report, it says they estimate $4 billion worth of gold was recovered. And that's just the gold. So,
what else have you found in those records? I'm curious, what have you learned about your father from those records, other than the story you've been telling here? Is there anything personal about him that you didn't know that
share with us? I did find that he'd been nominated for a Legion of Merit award. No, not at all. I did find another interesting thing. I found a memo in these files from General Frank McSherry, who was the head of the G5 section of SHAEF, saying they had found 30 carloads of patent records in a salt mine named the Herringen Salt Mine.
Did you say patent?
Patent.
P-A-T-E-N-T.
Right. Not George.
George.
Right.
Right, sorry.
And when I told Bill Wells, the historian, about this, he said, wow, if they hadn't found those patent records, the world would still be in litigation over these patents. So I thought that was fascinating. I'm just shocked. I mean,
Those records include his handwriting, notes.
He
did interrogate some of these German bank officials.
There was one long interrogation written up in which he interrogated an official with IB Farben Company that produced Cyclone B, the poison gas used in the gas chambers. And he's interrogating the guy, and the official says, he's complaining about the inhumane bombing tactics, Allied bombing tactics. He says he has a concussion and he's bitterly complaining. And my father says to him, well, Germany started the war. And he replied, my dear sir, any history book will show that Britain declared war on Germany without any mention of Poland and all the events leading up to the war. So he wrote, there was a long memo about that. Hmm.
Susan, this has been really interesting and an adventure for you. I'm curious what you're doing with this now. I mean, it sounds like there's a book.
I'd like to do a book.
Joel Fisher sounds like the subject of a book.
He could be a novel.
What a life he had.
He could be several books. How
old was he when he died? 97.
He was 79. Hmm. He died. He would have been 98 this year if he were still alive, 18 years ago.
It sounds like there's a book in there.
Several books.
Yeah, maybe so. And George Clooney as Joel Fisher in a forthcoming film. That's what I would say. Well, Susan Sullum has been our guest. You can find a link. If you didn't get a chance to read her story from the Washington Post magazine from last year, there's a fresh link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Thank you, Susan. This has been most enjoyable. And congratulations on digging through there and finding out more about your dad and sharing that with the rest of us.
It's been a great retirement since I retired.
Yeah,
from Senator
I would say
Carr
so.
I
yeah.
Opened up a whole nother life.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our midday Friday. I hope you enjoyed the program and come back again next week. We'll see you again soon. Have a great weekend.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Samantha Max, Beatrix Lockwood, and Max Bookdahl. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.